This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Matt, we are here to talk about what I think is strongly one of the more beloved of the Al originals in his discography.
I'm going to call this and a very special episode.
This is a very special episode. People love this one. Yeah. And I'm excited for the person we have as a guest. I just met this guest no more than a month ago when he appeared on Horror Movie Night to promote his incredible movie on Shudder, called Destroy All Neighbors, which stars another beloved Weird Al fan, Jonah Ray. And during our interview, he just, without me coaxing it out of him, mentioned UHF. And I said, this is a man that needs to be on our Weird Al podcast. So I am very excited to have Josh Forbes on the show. Josh.
Hey.
First of all, I just got to tell you, it has been like filling my nerdy heart as someone who got to watch an advanced screening of the movie in December, texted a few friends and said, when this movie drops in January, you've got to watch it right away because it's going to be so, like, it's so much fun. And then just seeing everyone else also agreeing with that, it feels like the positive reaction to this Destroy All Neighbors movie has, like, not slowed down since it hit Shudder. So I love seeing it.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. That's great to hear. It's impossible to know From inside the cyclone, how everything is going. So that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, the one metric I keep using is we already have a fan who already got a tattoo of Vlad.
Wow, yeah. There you go.
So that's like something very concrete I can, like, you know.
Yeah, if nothing else, you can say someone has this permanently on their body. They liked it so much.
Like, we're doing pretty good on Rotten Tomatoes, and someone made a very bad decision.
Well, you know, this completely makes sense because the movie Destroy All Neighbors, your main character is a prog musician. So, of course, we talked about the most prog song in Weird Al's discography, an early REM style parody. So there's a couple reasons why we went with this. I reached out to you and said, we'd love to have you on the show. And you immediately wanted to do Frank's 2000-inch TV because, again, tying back into Destroy All Neighbors, you also, Destroy All Neighbors was not the first time you directed Jonah Ray. You directed his cover of the Frank's 2000-inch TV and tied it into your love of UHF. And that video, I emailed you immediately when the dots connected, because one of my favorite nerd jokes that I've ever seen in a music video, as I'm in the Wolfman's Got Nards Monster Squad documentary. I'm a huge Monster Squad nerd.
Oh, wow.
So the parody of the Stephen King Rules shirt in his video saying Dean Koontz is okay, I guess, is just so perfect and funny. Like, that alone, I was like, this is the best joke I've seen in a long time.
There are like so many things you have to understand to get.
Yeah,
to
it's get a lot of references to connect those. It is, yeah. Yeah.
It is the smallest Venn diagram connection I've ever seen in my life, but I fell like, right into it.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's like we're parodying a scene from a movie that's parodying a music video.
That also just has a reference to a very obscure 80s kids movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the layer sandwich there is great.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm sure that beyond doing that video, you're also just a fan of the song Frank's 2000-inch TV.
Yeah. I mean, and just in Weird Al in general. I mean, I think I was thinking about how much UHF, I think, like, kind of was my first foray into, like, you know, if not, like, horror comedy, but, like, gore comedy. As far as like, you know, like when Emo Phillips cuts his finger off or, you know,
there's some shocking moments in that movie.
Yeah.
Like really I always think of the Conan the Librarian where he just splits a dude down the center. Like,
yeah, that was just so extreme for me. And it was just like, it was something that just stuck in my head forever. I mean, the story that I always tell, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but it's
that's
like,
what we do. Don't worry about
that's
it.
That's what our show is.
That's our whole thing.
So when I was in sixth grade, which is funny because I have I have two children, two boys, and one of them's in sixth grade now. But when I was in sixth grade, I went to like a co-ed party. It was like the first time a kid in our class like had a party, and it was boys and girls. And I went and I had like a terrible time. It was just so awkward. Like, these kids kept playing Two Live Crew and it just scared me. I was like, you know, is Jesus going to come and throw me right in the hell? Whatever. It was just like, it was a terrible time. Oh, they had 7 minutes in heaven and they threw me in a closet with the girl that was like the girl of my dreams. And the second we walked in, she just like shook her head like nothing happens.
Jesus.
So, and yeah, you're going to have 7 minutes in silence is what you're about to have.
So needless to say, it was just a terrible, terrible time. And when we were done, my dad picked me up and he could see that I was kind of looking down, you know, and he's like, oh, what's the matter, buddy? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, he's like, well, maybe we could go watch a movie to cheer you up. And like, we went to the video store and we got UHF and like, it just completely like transformed my mood and my entire life trajectory at that point.
My like, God, that's, you couldn't have written a better origin story for an, like, that is insane.
Yeah.
That is like a teen comedy.
Yeah. Right. But that also checks off so many of the boxes that we've talked about on this show, right? Because we're like,
100%.
Pre-teen male is the number one demographic for discovering and loving Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Yeah.
I love so much about that. Josh, if you ever decide to do a non-horror movie, you need to do like an American Graffiti style retelling.
Oh, I would love to do that. Yeah. Like Freaks and Geeks. Yeah.
Yeah, you're like, remember that time in 89? And like, that's
exactly.
Right. Yeah. I feel like that was like, I don't know if you've seen, I'm imagining you guys have seen Freaks and Geeks.
Sure. Yeah.
Like the Bill Havlicek, the moment when he's like, he's watching Gary Shandling and eating a sandwich and just laughing his head off. Like that's what UHF was for me.
It's one of my favorite TV moments of all time.
Yeah.
That feels like my childhood as well. This sense of like finding a connection, not from another person, but this other, like, it's just, you can't believe that you found someone or something in the world that feels like you understand and understands you back. And it's wild.
Right.
It's so good.
It's funny, we're talking about this and it's all hitting a thing that I literally saw and commented on a Facebook post literally yesterday. A friend of mine, Mike, had posted a thing about Saturday Night Live and how like he's so frustrated that so many people are like, Saturday Night Live's not funny, when it's like literally been on like 2 or 3 years of some of the strongest run that they've ever had with a great cast. Mm-hmm. But he said when Saturday Night Live comes up in conversation, it seems like everyone can weigh in about their childhood and teenage years of watching it. And I love that. But when I was a comedy nerd in sixth grade watching Weird Al music videos on VHS tapes at slumber parties and quoting SNL every Monday at school, I felt like it was just me and my couple of nerdy friends who even cared about it. And he goes, it makes me wonder, with no judgment or complete acceptance for anyone willing to be honest, do any of y'all out there feel like you couldn't be open about your love of something as a kid that you were enjoying and it wasn't until your adult years? And I wrote back and said, like, I, throughout most of middle school and high school, I subconsciously buried my love of the Muppets and Weird Al to survive.
Oh, yeah.
And now I'm known as like the dude who loves Muppets and has a Weird Al podcast. Like,
Weird Al absolutely makes that, hits that for me, all the way to the point where, unfortunately, the reality of the situation is that I actually did stop listening to Al for a few years, and I'm sure a part of that had to do with straight, you know, peer pressure or a sense of like,
oh yeah,
no, I need to be listening to whatever's popular at the time purely for survival. Like, it's like, what do I have to do to get through this?
If I'm being honest, and look, like, I'll out myself right now, host of a Weird Al podcast. I don't think I knew that albums had come out between Running with Scissors and Alpocalypse, because it was in that exact time period where I was just acting like I didn't know. You know,
I was very quietly following the whole thing, but definitely not talking about it.
Poodle Hat's the one that he barely really got any promotion about because Eminem stopped the Couch Potato.
Poodle Hat video was the one where the video got halted at the last second.
Yeah. And that, so, like, I had no clue until White and Nerdy that he was even still putting out music. Yeah. Like, I had just missed a full, like, album and, like, 8-year cycle of music. Because it was right at that point when I was in high school and wasn't paying attention to that stuff. And then again, yes. And he had no music video to promote, which was like the easiest way to discover stuff, especially circa 2003, 2004. Like,
I feel like White and Nerdy was a, I hate the term comeback because it's like
the man's had like six of them.
He really had. But I feel like that was like that was definitely like a big, like, him popping back up moment for me in the consciousness. But
White and Nerdy was also a big moment where the artist being parodied was so public with their appreciation and approval of the parody that, you know, like, it's always been the statement that, like, when Al parodies you, it's like this honor, or it's the statement that you've really made it. But I honestly think Chamillionaire is a huge element of, like, Al being cool from that point on, because he was like, you know, Chamillionaire is a one-hit wonder, but like, he at the peak of his popularity is being parodied by Weird Al and like won't stop talking about how great this parody is in any interview that he's giving. And I think that followed immediately by like the Lady Gaga trying to stop perform this way and like all of her fans being like, what are you doing? Like, that, it was like those two moments, I think, just officially sealed the fate that like Al was just going to be this beloved figure forever, and that was never going to go away or stop for the rest of his career.
He had a couple very public ones after that, the Lady Gaga one, and then also he did a James Blunt parody.
James
that
Blunt
got blocked
is
as well. And
that one's devastating because that's the label. He had
James
Blunt gave him the okay.
Jumping ahead, that's why he released it anyway, because James Blunt said yes and the label said no. So Al was like, okay, fine, well then I'll release it for free on my website, because they couldn't stop him from doing that. And he knew James Blunt didn't have a problem with it, so it was he was fine with it.
But, I can't wait till we get to your pitiful. That is a delightful
To go back to what you were saying, Josh, we said before on the show, like, it is kind of a comeback for him, but more than that, we always say it's like the moment where he gets reintroduced to a new generation.
Right, these milestone
moments of like, he hits this perfect point where the kids of that time just suddenly get that exposure of just like, oh my God, this guy is so brilliant. I can't believe how brilliant he is. And he's done that now over the span of his career, like at least four times or so.
Yeah,
he's hit new decade markers. It's incredible how many times he's pulled it off.
And I think the biggest thing is that his back catalog, for the most part, hasn't aged poorly.
No.
So, like, you know, if he puts out, let's say, hypothetically, he drops a surprise album in 2024.
Yeah.
And, like, all of the elementary school kids suddenly discover who Weird Al is. They have 40 years of content that would still make them laugh in 2023 as hard as it made us laugh in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Like, because he stuck with, I think that's the brilliance of sticking with stuff like food, is that it's a universal thing. Like there's there's never going to be a point where like singing about eating too many Oreos stops being funny. So like,
well, that's a great segue into a song about a very large TV.
In
a world now where TVs have gotten much, much, much bigger, but still, this is a damn big TV. No doubt about it.
It's a very, very universal topic.
Yes, the appeal
Before fully jumping into the Frank song, like I was listening back to the Alapalooza record, and it's like he has an interesting formula of like he often combines an old thing with a new thing. So like he'll have a song, you know, it's like a Chili Peppers song that's like contemporary to the day, but then he's talking about the Flintstones,
right?
Or you know the Beverly Hillbillies or something, like stuff that like the kid, like a kid that would be listening to it now, it's automatically too old,
right?
It's already way retro, and there's something like really genius about that because it sort of scrambles the timeline a little bit and like makes, if you want to, if like you already have access to it because of the song, like it's a contemporary song, like so a kid can be like, oh, this is a funny song on, you know, something that I relate to, but I don't really know what this thing is. And it makes you sort of dig deeper, or like the, you know, but then he'll do the reverse of it where it's like, the Yoda, you know, the Lola
with Kinks. Yeah.
I was going to say Jurassic Park. We talked about that Jurassic Park on this same album, taking that song from the 60s.
Yeah. 100%.
So it's like, okay, I know Jurassic Park. It just came out. I'm into it. And then it's like, what is this song about, you know, leaving the cake out in the rain?
Exactly.
Because that was not, you know, that was like a song from the 60s or something.
So, oh, yeah. No, we've, in a couple episodes ago, we talked about Jurassic Park, and he had said that, like, not surprisingly, MTV, nobody wanted to play it because it was such an uncool song. Like, as much as Jurassic Park was super hot at the time, like, no one was really interested in MacArthur Park. It did not fit into this early 90s grunge format that everyone had adopted. So, but no, I agree. Like, the hodgepodge of, like, the culturally relevant thing paired with something so old that a lot of people won't know about it.
I love how you described it. It blends the timeline.
It blends timelines. Like
it
really does,
because my knowledge base of old comedy was strengthened by loving Weird Al. Mm-hmm. Like, I never watched Beverly Hillbillies. I've actually, this is something I'm embarrassed to say, but I've never even watched I Love Lucy. But my knowledge base of both of those things are so strengthened because, you know, Amish Paradise came out at the right age for me, and then at that exact same time was a VHS tape of every one of his music videos that I bought, and just was like, oh, okay, I'm aware of this thing that's on at Nick at Night when I go to bed. Like, oh, I get this. Like, it is really cool how he is able to do that, and I think it makes sense because so much of what Al does, and this is something we talked about in our very first episode, but, like, so much of what Al does is a throwback to, like, 30s comedy records. You know what I mean? Right. Like, he's pulling so much of Spike Jones and Stan Freberg and Benny Bell and all of these, like, wacky comedy musicians, and he's just, like, finding a way to blend 30s stuff, modern day stuff, and his own childhood nostalgic stuff into like this weird little stew that it doesn't matter how old you are, as long as you're a Weird Al fan, it's just like all references that you understand and appreciate now because of him. Like,
it's safe for kids, but it's also like a little dangerous. A little,
it's got an edge. It's got an edge to it.
There's an occasional, you know, murder or being tied to a chair, or
it can get really rough. He could really enter some intense horror movie terrain with some of his subject matter, for sure.
But I think that's
why the cross section of horror fans and Weird Al fans is a very strong one.
Because
it is like, It feels dangerous. It doesn't feel as dangerous as, say, listening to Live Crew in sixth grade. But it is one of those things where, like, even a kid, I think, listening to some of this knows, like, oh, this is this is messed up.
It depends on the song, but we talked a lot. He has a song called Good Old Days. I don't know if you're familiar with that, where it is literally like Taylor style, a serial killer reflecting on his childhood.
Yeah.
And it is horrific. really rough. Like, honestly, even in this day and age, like, it's hard to imagine some of the things he says someone filming now.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's presented in this, like, again, it's, he's always, he's, he doesn't, we've said before, Al does not make kids music, but he makes music that is designed to be just right in this, like, adolescent sweet spot where it's not, it's PG-13. Yeah. It's actually barely even PG-13, but it's just edgy enough that you feel like when you're a kid and you hear it, you're like, I'm getting something that I maybe shouldn't be here. It's just edgy enough.
But his character, he has such integrity, at least from the outside, but I believe it to be true that he's just so well known as a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That he can get away with, you know, this stuff that's a little, you know, very on the edge.
First person edgy stuff. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That, like, I mean, like, if Blippi or something, I don't know. I mean, well, Blippi has his own dark past, but like some other like kid entertainer or something, like, you know, if you just turned on a kid's cartoon and it was like talking about whatever, you know.
Miss Rachel suddenly did an episode about tying her ex-boyfriend in high school up in a chair and leaving him in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
Her stock would plummet. Like, no. it'd be all over. Well, I think, you know, we're talking about like that element of scary. And like when I was a kid, and I think that this completely combines with what we're talking about with that Weird Al balance, is like, when I was a kid, I was afraid to watch horror movies. I was terrified to watch them. But what I would watch was like the old black and white Universal monster movies, because it felt like it gave me that element of being scared, but in like a safe environment. And I think that Al plays in that PG black and white Universal movie kind of world, where it's like you're still going to see someone get murdered in this movie. But like, you can separate yourself enough from being like, the world's not in black. Like, as a kid that sees the world in color, the fact that it's in black and white somehow just immediately makes you disconnect from it being real.
Yeah. I mean, and then as a guy who has kids too, it's like I'm shocked at how many times I'm playing it and I'm like, ooh, maybe I should turn this down, or maybe like, and I've exposed my kids to all sorts of, you know, craziness or whatever, I think there's like value in that of just like, it's a little scary, you know, like, let's see what they do with it.
It's so funny that we're having this deep dive into this, because honestly, one of the most tamest songs in his catalog is Frank's 2000 Inch TV,
absolutely,
which is more just like an ode.
I would say, could not be more wholesome song. Yeah, I love this. Is such a wonderful, wholesome track about a community coming together.
Right.
It's actually one of his sweetest songs. I think this is like one of the sweetest songs he has ever written. Like, it's really, I love that we went to the horror route. Of course, we went to the horror route with you, Josh, but still, like, it's great.
Yeah.
But it helps because, man, like, I've talked about this a million times on the show. Obviously, it's one of his favorite bands, but also one of my favorite bands is REM. Mm-hmm. And like, there, it's hard to pinpoint what is the sound of REM, right? Because over 30 or 40 years, they've dabbled with so many sounds. Monster sounds dramatically different than, say, Murmur, which sounds dramatically different from, like, you know, Action for the People. You know what I mean? But like, when you hear a song that's inspired by REM, you can tell immediately. And like, this is like he captures that, like, it's almost, I would say it's comparable to like Shiny Happy People, I feel like, is the closest vibe of what he's going for.
It definitely has some of that.
It's just so bright and lovable, and the mandolins in there, like, it's all of those elements of REM can be a very dour band at times. Like, they can absolutely be the most melodramatic dour band, but they also do happy so well, which he's already touched when he did Spam for the UHF soundtrack. And we get, he takes Stan and turns it into Spam. And this is just another one where he's able to unlock the sound of like the most joyful, upbeat REM songs to perfection. Like, I want to hear Michael Stipe cover this song in my life. I think it would be amazing.
Yeah.
I think that, REM are a great example. We've talked about this before in some of the band's Al parodies, or style parodies specifically. it's worth saying, I think it is so hard, just as a musician, as someone who does this for a living. Like, I think the hardest thing in the world you can do as an artist is have such a unique voice in what you do, but not really have the listener be able to clearly tell what it is that you're doing differently. Like, yeah. On paper, mm-hmm. REM are a just standard alternative rock band from the 90s, and yet they have such a distinct sound. Both Michael Stipe's vocal delivery, the way they craft harmonies, the way they write hooks, the backing vocals, the mandolin parts, everything about it is... You will rarely mistake an REM song for somebody else. And that's right. Incredibly difficult to do as just a mainstream, yeah. Essentially a pop rock band.
I was going to say, coming from a guy whose band is often mislabeled as other bands, yes. When found on streaming.
Exactly. It's so hard to do that. Like, it's about the most... it's like, I can't give it up any more than that, to have been able to pull that off as a band. And... you know, it's actually, compared to other Al style parodies we've heard up until this point, like the B-52s or the Police or Devo, those are actually a mm-hmm. little bit more clear cut. Like, their tricks and what they do to be unique is a little bit more straightforward. You can tell, like, obviously the B-52s, it's like, you have someone who sings like this. And like, there's like things you can do that make it really obvious. This one, because of how subtle REM's unique qualities are, in a lot of ways, I think this is maybe one of the most impressive, if not the most impressive style parody he has ever done. Because this is so incredibly perfectly executed as an REM homage for, again, the reasons you're talking about. Like, yes, it's this shiny, happy people kind of vibe. It's yeah. shimmery, it's glowing and stuff, but it's... what makes it work, even to me, who've like, I learned this song, I've studied it kind of, well, I've definitely studied it for learning it and now for this show. And it works in ways that I don't even fully understand.
Yeah.
The extent to which he has nailed this is
it's not
shocking.
The most hilarious song he's ever written by a mile.
Mm-hmm. No,
like,
certainly
it's
not.
Actually, the humor is like, I would say at most it's like chuckle worthy lines every once right. in a while. There's not like a belly laugh to be found in the song, but I think it's there's certain songs by Al where I just have a big dumb smile on my face as I'm listening to it, and I think there are few songs in his catalog that I have a bigger, dumber smile on my face than when I'm listening to this one, because it's like you said, it is weirdly the most wholesome song in his catalog.
It's
like,
incredible.
We've talked about like the normal Al Yankovic songs,
yeah,
and like a lot of them are still songs like Melanie that are a little dark or like edgy, and this is just the most upbeat, positively. You said it's about a community coming together because Frank bought this outrageously large TV and now everybody loves to just be around.
I love Frank. The fact, you could easily imagine a reading of this song where this TV is a huge nuisance and everyone's annoyed,
oh, sure.
But yeah. No one's annoyed. Yeah. Everyone's thrilled that they get to watch 90,000 watts of audio. This should be a problem.
Yeah. Right. No, this is one of those songs that it could have easily gone in the route of like I Remember Larry, where the town like turns on him and kills him.
Torches, like... pitchforks, yeah, and like we gotta tear this TV down. No, everyone loves it.
In the darkest corners of the internet, a nameless, formless entity has been growing. No one dares question where it was created or what it wants. But those who have been entranced by its musings chant its blood-curdling name in unison. Horror Movie Night!
Find Horror Movie Night on your favorite podcasting app or at hmnpodcast.com.
I also want to, because again, Michael Stipe, lyrically, REM is known for these sort of like elusive, poetic, like he's very poetic in his lyrics. And this mm-hmm. whole song doesn't do that. But the first two lines of this song that Al writes... rising above the city, blocking out the noonday sun, it dwarves the mighty redwoods, and it towers over everyone. That yeah, is a beautifully written line. Like, it's that's gorgeous.
There's barely any jokes in the whole song.
Yeah, no, it's really light. Yeah.
Like, it's mostly just, like, yeah, painting this lovely picture of...
Yeah.
I mean, I do think there's a tinge of, yeah, like, maybe it's not even darkness, but, like, There's something kind of generally like sort of sad about like a world raised by television and obsessed by, you know, Robert De Niro's giant mole or something.
Yeah, it's almost 10 feet wide. It's got to be 10 feet wide.
but also it's like it, I don't know. It reminds me of being that kid watching UHF. Like,
yeah.
The reason why I love UHF is because I was in so many ways, you know, raised by television.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my family in a lot of ways. And these are the people I care about. And like, this is as like thin and substanceless as that is,
mm-hmm.
like there is great depth to it as well. Like, and in the collective, like absurdity of, like, we're just going to gather around and, you know, this is our 2001 obelisk, or this is our, like,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
The Mayans had their temples and the Egyptians had their pyramids and we have our giant TV.
Al's done a lot of songs about TV and about specific shows. And he does a thing a lot where he will make fun of a show at great mm-hmm. length. Again, like, there's a whole song about making fun of Gilligan's Island. There's a song like he mocks America's Funniest Home Videos. He will poke fun mm-hmm. at all of these shows, you know, in a big way, but also always kind of spins it back around to this place of love and mm-hmm. appreciation of, like, I know it's dumb, but it means a lot to me. And I think this song, in a way, is a perfect encapsulation of that. And I actually love, not to jump ahead a little bit, but the fact that he references The Simpsons as the mm-hmm. show that people are watching is the perfect reference point for...
Oh, totally.
Especially at this time, like, unassailably great, right? Like, he couldn't have picked a more, like, beloved, perfect show to reference. Like, there's no snark at all in everyone enjoying watching The Simpsons together on this enormous TV.
Right.
Well,
and The Simpsons is just such an amalgamation of all of pop culture, you know,
exactly.
The entirety of televised pop culture and, you know, high, what I love about him too, it's like, it's high and low. It's like the, you know, you can go Shakespearean or you can go like throwing pies in the face mm-hmm. or whatever.
Totally.
And
totally.
it's all there in The Simpsons. Yeah. So that's a great.
It brings to mind two different things in my head simultaneously. So, first of all, I think The Simpsons, you're right. The Simpsons is a perfect reference point for a couple reasons. Because, A, we know Al as, like, a pop culture guru. Mm-hmm. And what is a bigger show, like you said, of encapsulating pop culture than The Simpsons. But also, it kind of fits into the theming of the song. Because, again, we're talking about how this song is essentially about this guy buying an outrageously cartoonish purchase. And it bringing mm-hmm. the community together. And, like, at its core, I've been binge-watching The Simpsons from the very beginning lately. And, like, mm-hmm. in re-watching it, it's like, man, so much of this show isn't about The Simpsons. It's about Springfield. And it's about the community of Springfield and this, like, mm-hmm. giant tapestry of well over 100 to 200 characters and how closely knit that whole town is with each other, where everybody knows everybody, which kind of fits into the framework of what he's creating in this world for Frank's 2000 inch TV, where everybody knows about this television, knows about Frank, and it brings them together. Mm-hmm. But then I want to go back to earlier when we were talking about that Freaks and Geeks moment of mm-hmm. Bill watching Gary Shandling and just laughing with himself. And, you know, it's been very well established that Al was kind of a loner throughout most of his life. He was mm-hmm. way too smart, graduated high school, I think a year early, went to college mm-hmm. a year sooner than most people.
He was a young accordion player.
Yeah. I mean, like,
it's all there.
It's hard to not imagine that maybe Al writes so many songs about television because, like a lot of us who were young, nerdy kids, mm-hmm. television was like that one thing that made us feel not as alone.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think that it's kind of interesting that he is writing this song about television bringing a community together, because I think it is similarly to how I talk about how I think I'm a clone now is like a very revealing song about how Al sees himself. I think that there's a lot of what Al thinks is the positives in television mm-hmm. in this song, making fun of outrageous consumerism.
Yeah.
Like, he still sees the value in, like, you know, there stuff like the MASH finale being this gigantic thing that everyone mm-hmm. came together mm-hmm. for, the Friends finale. Like, why do we all gather around and watch these last episodes of important shows together? Because they feel like they're part of our friend group by the time the show is wrapping up. We've grown with them for 12 years or whatever. So yeah. I think it's a really smart choice for him to not go the snarky route with this particular song. And I think it's telling that Al doesn't go.
I totally agree. Route with this. I had to do a quick lookup for the time that this came out. The Simpsons would have just ended season 4.
I was going to say, it's still very early in there.
Which couldn't be more primo. I mean, if you're looking at the for episodes, I don't know how many of our listeners are Simpsons fanatics, but you should be. Camp Krusty, Homer the Heretic, Itchy and Scratchy the Movie, Mr. Plow, Marge versus the Monorail. I mean, this is like golden, golden age
Simpsons.
This
is the last of the Conan.
This is Conan O'Brien writing a lot for the Simpsons. And I mean, this is... of course, Al would have been absolutely obsessed at this time with this show. And again, no snark at all.
But he's very selective too about what he references. Like there's some stuff that's like intentionally dated, and then there's some stuff that's very timeless.
Yeah.
And so for him, but I think him referencing The Simpsons, I think kind of falls into the timeless camp for me, where it's like I think he knew. Like,
he knew that that was, I mean, I don't think he knew it would still be on television 30-something years later.
Again, I would say season 4, I mean, we often will give him credit for being quite the oracle with knowing what to reference and knowing what to parody in terms of songs that have stood the test of time. Calling out The Simpsons at season 4, I mean, it certainly was huge. No getting around it. But yeah, he couldn't. I can't imagine he would have guessed that it was going to still be on the air.
Season 4 is still 20 early years enough later. In the show's run. Yeah, that's early
enough.
Wait,
no, 30
in
years later. Excuse me. I'm 30 years later.
But that's early enough in a show's run that it could still have like fallen off in season 5 and disappeared by season 6 and people don't barely remember it.
At this moment in time in the history of the world, no show had run for 30 years. that wasn't even a possibility.
That wasn't like 60 minutes.
Exactly.
Right. But speaking of the whole thing of bringing the town together and stuff, like I think that must have been why I chose to make our video based off of UHF to back it up a little bit. So Jonah Ray, comedian, friend, star of my film, Destroy All Neighbors. He has a band. You Can't Call Me Al, I think is the name of that's at least the album.
Yeah, the name of the record. Yeah.
So he has a punk band that basically covers all of the Al originals, basically. And so, he was like coming out with this album and I was like, oh, do you have any plans to do any videos? And he's like, not really. And so I'm like, let me listen to some of the songs. And I heard Frank's and then I was like, oh, like, what if we, what if we just tried to Forrest Gump you into UHF? Like, how would that even work? And he's like, yeah, all right. And so I had my friend Andy Young, who's an editor, who's just brilliant. Like, I had pulled together a bunch of clips of moments that I thought would be fun. But I had way more than we needed. And Andy cut together just like kind of the perfect, like his editing for that video is just so good. You know, it's fun when I can kind of like toot my own horn because it's like not even my horn. It's Andy's horn. He was just like crushed it. And so we, you know, using that video as a template, then we went through and like, you know, Jonah had a buddy who had a green screen and like, you know, we did it for no money. We just like did it for the cost of snacks and stuff. And well, actually we had to pay my friend's kid, Zane Reynolds, who's an awesome dude. He did the prosthetic makeup. I think maybe we gave him some money for like the moment when he gets his cheek pulled or whatever. we like worked so hard to achieve a lot of these looks that like you only see for like half a second.
But it's phenomenal. I mean, listen, if any of you are listening to Weird Algorithm and you haven't watched Jonah Ray's music video for Frank's 2000-inch TV, like, get on it. Like,
you're also in for a treat because if we haven't made it totally clear, Jonah Ray's version of Frank's 2000-inch TV is not a REM style parody.
No. Right. Yeah.
It is very different. It is a punk rock song. It is one quarter of the length, I think, probably, roughly. It zips by at a breezy, like, less than 90 seconds.
Yeah. So it's hard for me to, like, when you guys are talking about the REM aspect of it, like, I don't think I fully picked up on that, but it's mainly because like when I think of the song, I think of like Jonah's.
Sure. Of course. Of course. Yeah.
Punk version of it.
No, it makes total sense. Yeah.
But that was one where like Weird Al, I think he retweeted it or he liked it or something. Like,
that's awesome.
Whatever it was, I was like, this is, I'm in heaven.
A milestone. Yeah, absolutely.
And then maybe, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the other podcast, but Weird Al showed up to our premiere of our movie.
Oh, really? That's a great. Wow.
Yeah. Which was just so like, it was like beyond, like it was beyond cool. And it is more just like, oh, am I dying? Is my reality collapsing in on itself? Like,
yeah,
I couldn't even really appreciate it.
Yeah. I love that.
You know what I mean? It's like,
of course, yeah.
Like if you're like my dead grandpa just showed up or something. It had that feeling of like, okay, this is, I'm on the Truman Show and like, where's the camera, you know?
Yeah.
But the fact that, cause he could be like the guy who in so many ways, like started off, inspired my career, just shows up to see my first big movie. You
know? No, that's, like, that's amazing, man. What a dream.
It's pretty special.
What a dream. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unless Matt's got anything else, I think we're about at the ranking
point. I have a couple more just like lyrics, okay, I want to point out, if you don't mind, Matt Kelly, my classic move. I particularly like right after the one line I read, I still remember when that delivery truck came down our block. What a lucky guy. I hear he got the last one in stock. I like that idea that there's more of these out in the world. I don't know how many this company made of this 2000 inch TV. A nice little, this is a deep reference, but I like the fact he says, and the neighbors are just green. Green is the name of an REM record. That's a great little throw in. Green was the album that had come out maybe just before this or maybe close to it.
Green is 89, 91 they had.
Out of Time.
It was a couple out of albums ago because I think Automatic for the People came out the year before this. So, but still, it was kind of one of the big albums to put them on the map in the mainstream.
Green was the album that made REM really famous. There's a running joke. I might have even said this on a previous
REM
thing.
You said this
thing
on the show before because I was about to say it.
Indie record snob said they called the album Green because it was about all the money they were going to make. Making commercially, finally making commercially successful music. Yeah, exactly. I found online someone did a very deep analysis of the 2000 inch TV here, and if indeed you could have a 2000 inch TV that could produce Robert De Niro's mole at 10 feet wide.
Oh no!
I will tell you, it was such a. It took me so long to read, and it wasn't that interesting. But I will, so I'm not going to recite the whole thing to you now, but I will say that someone confirmed that, yes, a 2000 inch TV, presuming 1993, it is a 4:3 old school aspect ratio, would mean it was 1600 by 1200 inches the rectangle of it. And in certain moments from Taxi Driver, there are sufficient enough close-ups of De Niro's face that he would have indeed had a 10-foot mole. So if anyone was concerned, Al did do the math. Apparently it checks out, and there, you could have indeed seen a 10-foot mole on Frank's TV, if that makes you feel better. And then the other thing that people were debating is 90,000 watts of sound, of Dolby sound. Is that actually a realistic number? And it kind of is. 90,000 watts is about how much wattage you'd have if you were seeing a reasonably large rock show, like an outdoor amphitheater type outdoor space show. It's actually not, it's believable. The stats on this song do line up as per usual. Al did all the research like he did with I Want a New Duck. He went to the library and he researched audio video, which I love.
We're really checking off the algorithm.
You know what? We just got to make sure. I like to fact check these songs to great detail. Shout out to the Reddit people who really, really did a deep dive on this. It was very, very well done.
I do like that because I think there used to be a lot of songs or whatever making fun of television, or I mean a lot, like a hand, like, and that didn't age well. Like I think like Bruce Springsteen had a song called 57 Channels and Nothing On.
That's right. Yeah, and yeah.
It's like that's what my TV comes with now, like just without being plugged into anything, like without even being on. I think there's probably 57.
Even Al has an older song called Cable TV that is just about how annoyed he is at how many options there are, and now it feels incredibly reasonable.
I think he complains about there being like 80 channels.
Yeah,
it's like man, I don't even think Pluto has 80 channels on it.
Right. But a TV that big, that still is, that still is even out in the future. We don't even have,
It is.
How does it compare to like a movie screen?
It is larger still. So again, aspect ratios have changed, right? But the research that these people did indicates that it is still actually larger than even the largest screen available in the world now. Okay. It is bigger than that. I don't know if I have that number immediately handy, but they did say that, I think the largest screen in the world right now, our largest setup, is somewhere in Australia, and this is significantly bigger than that still. So even by today's large TV standards, this is... this is hefty.
I love that I asked you as if you would know. And
no, you've come to the right place. This is, don't worry, I have all this information right here. I'm actually embarrassed with myself that I don't have the size of that screen ready to go, because I definitely saw it at some point.
You're in the right place.
You're in the right place for all that kind of stuff. And then, I mean, the only other thing I want to note, like in terms of the REM of it all, like the things that I actually think it is one of the most like beautiful pieces of music, and it's very REM, but the little bridge that he does, the hey now, and all the backing vocals that go around it. It's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. One of the other like little REM tricks that he does so well in this song is the backing vocals that come in at different times. Like they're off by a beat and they kind of like layer over each other in these really weird ways. Like as if everyone in the band, no one quite knows how it goes and they're all just doing different parts at different times. And it just creates this like a halo around the whole thing. It's so beautifully done. We get a nice key change at the end. He does a modulation, which is also a very REM thing. Stan does that too. This is a perfect style parody. If I haven't made that clear, this is perfect.
And it's so perfect, Matt, that while I'm not putting it as my number one Al original, it is cracking my top five. I'm actually putting it at number three, just below UHF and Dare to Be Stupid, as I think the third best Al original that we've come upon in this journey. And I'm curious, because you're sharing even more praise. Is this topping your list, Matt?
Frank's 2000-inch TV is my number one Weird Al original.
There we go.
Wow.
As of this moment, I really do. Again, like, yeah, no, this is so, this is absolutely everything I love about Al is in this track. I cannot believe the musicianship, the intelligence, and it's just, I don't know. Again, I've said before, we talked about this on Airline Amy, on Melanie. When I think about someone who would come to me and be like, this Al guy who you like enough that you host a podcast, I know two of his parodies. Why do you like him so much? This is top of the list of something to play someone who's not familiar with him to show how brilliant he can be and how great, how good he is at just writing a song. It's hard for me to imagine someone not getting some joy out of this as a piece of music. I just think it's so, so well done. Yeah, that's it. Number one.
Well, lastly, Josh, I sent you a typed up version of the list, but we have our guest rankings list here. Now you get the honor of placing Frank's 2000-inch TV anywhere on the list that you want. And you can move a song if you think it's ranked too low or too high into a position you think is more appropriate.
Okay, so out of these 33 songs that are in this list,
yeah,
starting with Taco Grande and ending with Eat It,
yep.
Man, this list is crazy. Who puts Taco Grande at the top? That's insane. Oh, can I throw that one somewhere down?
You can move Taco Grande down.
You could put Taco Grande to the bottom. You could put it in the middle. I always say put your song first. I think it's best to place your song and then make the move.
I think I would put it after Yoda and before I Lost on Jeopardy.
Okay, that is a very fair spot. Those are two heavy hitters in the parody world. Yeah,
you know, this is not an ostentatious placement. It's like I don't think it'll get moved from there.
No, that's a good call.
And then I can just move one.
Yep.
Yeah, you can tell.
Because I would move Taco Grande to the very bottom.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. So I think it's fun. I mean, it's very funny, but I mean, you know, Eat It is like, come on.
No, you did it exactly right.
Yeah. There's a challenge of like what's classic and then what's like legit good and what's funny, what's just straight up funny. I think that one's a funny one, but I don't think it has the last. I feel like that one does the thing the opposite of what I was talking about. Like it combines two very temporary things.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for being a great guest. And
yeah,
I mean, once again, everybody, first of all, if you're a horror fan, you should already have Shudder. I don't know what you're doing not having Shudder.
Right.
It's,
get with it.
It's in many ways the only place where the movies that you grew up liking as a horror fan are available to watch.
Yeah.
But while you're watching all those classic films from your childhood, absolutely take the 90 minutes to watch Destroy All Neighbors, and then go get it tattooed on your body, I think is
exactly
what the takeaway is.
That's the process. You first watch the movie, then get the tattoo, and then shoot us an email with the photographic evidence.
I mean, if you're a fan of Weird Al and a fan of UHF, like I think there's the DNA runs, you know. If you 23'd in me this movie, I think a significant portion would be.
That's the DNA. That's the heritage.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's like a healthy mix of, I would say, a healthy blend of UHF, Return of the Living Dead, Dead Alive, and Evil Dead 2. I think is that's like the magic concoction. Plus a whole lot of great prog rock music. So
yeah,
like
maybe like a little Airheads or like Wayne's World or something. Yeah,
yeah, it's amazing. Josh, we cannot wait to have you back on the show one
of
these days. And Matt, we'll be back next week talking about, we talked about how this is one of the nicest, most wholesome songs, and now we're about to talk about one of the meanest
parodies ever. I can't wait.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.